I'm Pearl Sia, alcoholic. And I came here and started up an old apartment house, and somebody said, Pearl, you've got a 12-step house here. You're taking in sick alcoholics and taking care of them in bed, something to eat. And I said, well, I don't know what that is. I've never been to California. They said they got them all over California. And I said, I don't know what that is. They said, well, when you take in sick alcoholics and nurse them and feed them and give them a bed till they get well, that's what a 12-step house was. That's what they told me. So I said, okay. And they stuck a 12-step house on my door. And so Pastor came to me one time, and he was wanting to straighten out his life at this house. So I took him in, but he didn't stay long. So I seen him one time in Oxnard, California. I went up to him, and I said, Clash, do you remember me? Pearl Cole from Los El Paso. That's me. So he said, well, next time I see Clash, he was at Santa Monica. So I went up and asked him again if he still remembered me. He said, yeah, Pearl Cole from El Paso. So I sure am so happy to have him here. And, you know, I came from Santa Monica. I guess Clarence was about that. California. I'm living out there now. And I came from Santa Paula, California to get to hear Clarence. So I wanted to say that.
I guess that's my introduction. My name is Clancy Immisland, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm, does anybody young in the program here want to get into action? No. Come here. Get me some Kool-Aid. Some Kool-Aid. And don't spit in it. Made me homesick for my old days in AA. Is anybody in the front row want to get in action? They must be left over from something else. I'm glad to be here. I'm very pleased to be here today. As was mentioned earlier, I did speak at the convention here a couple of years ago, but that was just a convention, and it wasn't, I go to conventions a lot. But there was something about coming here today for Founders Day that really touched me. And in fact, ordinarily I would have said no to this request, because I was speaking in Tacoma, Washington last night. And I had to get up at 5 o'clock in a cold rain this morning. And drive 40 miles to the airport to go to Salt Lake City, where I was married 3 times. Thank you. And changed planes, and I came down. I noticed us milling around the Salt Lake City airport this morning. At the plane stopped in Albuquerque, so I called ahead to Albuquerque. I have a bunch of kids in Albuquerque, oddly enough, and my wife is visiting them. So they all came down to the airport at 20 minutes to 12 in Albuquerque and brought me a clean shirt. Yeah. And my wife said, now, when you get down there, Clancy, don't act crazy like when we lived there. She's found Al-Anon. But I was glad to get here. And I was, when they talk about Founders Day in the old days, I've been listening to these guys talk. It made me feel kind of funny, because I always feel like a young slipper around AA sometimes. I get around old timers. And the gentleman who just spoke was talking about this group of exciting people who came in 1960, the old-timers. I had to stop thinking, I don't know any of them. They were all after my time. You know, who were those people? You know, and the Tularosa Club was after my time. And everything is, most of it, well, I remember Cecil. I always thought till today he was just a decoration in the club, just... like they have the gargoyles at Notre Dame and Cecil and Alamogordo Street. It's kind of a... But I was glad to see him, and he's a tough old bird, and I'm glad he's weathered his surgery. But I remember those days well. Pearl, the lady who introduced me today, in fact, on the airplane, I was wondering, I wonder what ever happened to that old Pearl. That's a true thing. And I got off, and somebody said, Pearl is going to be here. And I said, my goodness, that's great. Because I lived in El Paso, and I worked here, and Pearl had a 12-step house. When you live in a town and you work there, you usually don't wind up at a 12-step house. You go home. But the heat was on several times, and I sometimes would slink into Pearl's and lurk there for a day or two till everything eased off, and then I would slink out again. And Pearl was always very kind. There was always a bunch of old rummies around her house, and she was trying to help them. She was a very gracious lady. But I think about those days, and I think of going to AA meetings up in Alamogordo and hating them. And I had two sponsors. One guy, I don't know if anybody would remember him, Jim H. or Jim Haller, and he's dead now. He was a Sunday editor of the El Paso Times. And another guy was Bob R., who had a public relations firm downtown. And these guys tried to help me, and I was almost beyond the point of helping. And I was doing everything I could to hold it together. I had hitchhiked into El Paso following my last town. I was always a town or two ahead of my family. They would join me, but I was always on the run. I came here from San Francisco, and I was hotter than a firecracker. And I got into town here, and I got a little job. I did some little work for the Times. And I got a little job at Mithoff Advertising, and I worked there for a long time. And I did some more work for the Times. And I got a job. I was in the local theater. I do that part-time sometimes. And I was appointed to a job on the faculty of the Texas Western, and I directed a grand opera there in the spring of 1956, something called Mephistopheles by Arrigo Boito. And I was also I was writing some sports stuff, but I was doing little odd jobs, and my wife came in, and I shouldn't say this, but I had made a bad marriage. It's not that she was a bad woman, just worse than that. She was a good woman. And she was a good Catholic woman. And I'm a Lutheran boy. And I remember my grandmother saying, don't ever marry a Catholic. Grandma, we've been over there in the Pacific. I've been over there in the Pacific fighting yellow fascism to get rid of bigotry. So we can all live together as Americans. There's no more religions. We're just Americans. So I married this lovely girl, and my grandmother was right. As I say, it wasn't because she was a... It wasn't because she was a bad girl. What are you going to do now? I've never been able to act well in El Paso ever. I don't know what there is about this city. But there's one thing they never tell little Lutheran boys when you're going to marry a good Catholic girl. And that is, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family. Ready or not. And I used to plead with her. I'd say, Charlotte, my God, this is the brave new post-war world. Can't we use birth control?
No.
I said, you at least get something for the prevention of disease. They sell them in vending machine over here at Rocky's Rockaway.
No.
And this was when we lived in the Midwest, and she finally had a priest come by, and he talked to me for an hour and a half one day on the rhythm system and how you prevent babies. And I listened intently, and I just couldn't pick up that beat. I just... So in addition to all my other problems, I'd become a national distributor of small Catholics, you know.
Oh,
and I'd get a town, I'd be in a new town, I'd get squared away, and my wife would come in, and 9 months and 10 seconds later, and I had a bunch of kids, and I felt bad about that, because I'd had some good jobs and lost them, that's how I got to help. Hitchhiked in there with a guy I'd been in the Navy with, and he was coming down here to, because he was a voice, a guy named, he was not an alcoholic, his name was Tom O'Leary, and he was a voice, had a great voice, great basso. In fact, when he left here, he went to sing in Europe, in the opera. And I got these jobs. My wife came in shortly thereafter. She got pregnant. I had all these jobs going. I was getting... I've listened to enough kids in my life. I've got to change that posture. I was just, when I was in Albuquerque, I had several of my grandchildren come up and say, hi, Grandpa, so I'm now taking a new position, a kind of a grandfatherly tolerance. Let the little tyke holler if you want. Bring him up here, and Uncle Clancy will give him something. Yeah. And one day, they called me at the college and said something effective that they understood that I'd been acting bizarrely in Juarez. And like much of my life, I have a tendency to choke under pressure. That's usually connected with athletics, choking. That's when you, in case you're not familiar with that, that's when a hand visible only to yourself comes out of your shirt and grabs your neck. And sometimes that happens as you watch a third strike go by. Oh, God damn it. And sometimes you fumble a punt. But it also happens in interchange of relationship. And I wanted to tell this guy, I'm not acting bizarrely in Juarez. You know, it's just, you don't understand. What I said was... But what I thought of him, I thought, you don't understand. I am not acting, I'm not a bizarre person. I'm a much, very emotional person. And I'll tell you, I got a bunch of kids. I'm trying to hold two or three jobs at a time. I'm trying to make up for the last explosion. I just, it's everything going to hell. Some nights, kids hollering, and I'm thinking about all these things, the bill collectors hollering at me. And I can't sleep. My head is just racing. And maybe at 2 o'clock in the morning, I might go to Juarez, yes. And I might walk into Las Catacumbas or the Chinese Palace or one of the places where I'm known and loved. And I may have some tequila, y limón. Are you picketing me or something, kid? Move it. You know, I don't mind people looking at them when they have a look of disbelief. That hurts. I might have a tequila y limón y sal, and I may stand on the bar, which I do sometimes because that's cute, and I may sing my little song. Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. Yeah. Yeah. That relaxes me. That's what I was going to say, but what I said was... So he told me not to drink. And so I did try not to drink, and I went back to AA again. And even though by that time I'd been in and out of AA for 5 or 6 years, I knew I was an alcoholic. If that what they said was an alcoholic, that's not me. And I took it as long as I could, and the pressure was on. We did that opera up there and became a big success, and I was over, and the heat was on. I was half crazed, and one day my wife took the kids down to church. And I just parked the car in the garage and turned on the motor and went to sleep and died. That's the best I could do. And somebody found me in there dead. And they, I could have been dead long. They pulled me out and beat on my chest and blew up my nose and rushed me to the hospital and applied resuscitative measures. And then they put me in the psych ward for a couple of weeks and examined me. And I had a couple of friends in El Paso, one of whom I think I'm having dinner with tonight, who was not an alcoholic, but I had him convinced it wasn't what it seems. I just dozed off. He almost was able to get to the judge and get me out. But he couldn't. I'm glad he couldn't now, but I wasn't glad then. And they finally examined me, and the doctor decided that I was a badly split personality was my problem. And I was committed for an indefinite period, up to forever, to the Big Spring State Hospital at Big Spring, Texas. And it wasn't any kind of alcoholic commitment. Nothing to say anything about alcohol on my commitment papers. Just N-U-T, boy. Nut. And I was... I'll tell you, when I got there, I thought I'd been depressed before. Jesus, this is really, you know... When you've been committed for an indefinite to life at a Texas State Insane Asylum, that is really, that is what you call your basic resume buster. You really have to go to the whip on that one, you know. What you're doing all this time? Well, I was attending a university that later burned down without a trace. Yeah. Took a sailboat around the world. And I might have been there yet, except some guy said, you know, you can't escape from this joint. And I said, oh. And I felt my heart start. And about a week later, I'd found a way to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over the brick wall in front. And the fox was loose in Big Spring, Texas. And the sad thing is that, like most of West Texas, they tell you the truth. And that was true. That's an escape-proof hospital. But you don't know until you get out. Now, that sounds ironic, doesn't it? When you get out, you suddenly realize they can see you running for 3 days. And it's just a matter of time till they, you know... Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they brought me back and they gave me an autumn full of electric shock treatments. And once you've had an autumn full of electric shock treatments, you don't run much after that. You just kind of, what's your name? I don't know. I started to get a little bit better and... they broke me because I was willing to do anything. I don't know why. I just was willing to... just. I don't... When you've had a lot of shock treatments, you don't remember taking them. It knocks out your memory of them. But I remember afterwards, when we were on the ward, this D5, this terrible ward 5, and you're upstairs on the shock ward, and when you're coming off a shock, you don't know who you are much about it. You just know you're there. And I didn't remember coming to Texas for a while. That comes back after a while. But they didn't have many funds in the mid-50s. And this was just a bunch of brick buildings. They didn't have any nice buildings that they got now. And when they're giving shock treatments, they'd have guys come in, the guys off the shock treatments, and you'd hold a leg or something. Somebody else would hold another leg. And they'd give them a shock treatment. And you watch that body arch. Ah! And somebody, you're groggy. That's my body they're doing it to. And I just got so... they played organ music down the hall. That's how you knew they were giving shock treatments. They had a record of organ music they'd play every day. And I'll tell you, a couple of years later, when I was working in a different city, I could walk down the street and hear organ music and break into a sweat. Just boom. And boy, I understood what brainwashing is. I don't remember ever taking a shock treatment, but if they wanted the atomic secrets and I had them, I'd have given it to them. Anything you want for that money. Well, I started to come out of it a little bit, and then they saw my record. I directed this opera at the university up here. So that winter, they appointed me the director of the Christmas pageant at the Big Spring State Hospital, which was not much of a pageant. It was about the second grade level, so the whole student body could follow along, you know. And there wasn't any intricate direction. The director's main job was primarily just trying to hold the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you will. Get back there, Lamar. Get back. We just want to worship her, Clancy. And I started a hospital newspaper, and I did a lot of things. But I still would get very testy and cross sometimes. And every time I got testy and cross, some ward attendant would write it down, and I'd go. It looked like I was never going to get out of that place. I'm never going to get out of that place, because I had to be well to get out of there, and I had to look well to a bunch of $60 a month attendants, as far as I could see. Because their daily records told the doctor how you're doing. And that's scary. And you don't dare rebel much to give you more shock treatments. And I'll tell you, it's a... When I saw that one flew over the cuckoo's nest, if you could just take that back 30 years and make everything old-fashioned, that's the way that hospital was in the 1950s. And that's what saved my life. Most of my memory was back then. I was desperate and frantic, and the heat was on. My wife was having problems, and everything was going to hell. And I knew my life was over. I would never work again. And they tried a pilot program. They started a pilot program in the state of Texas at the Big Spring State Hospital. By a stroke of luck for me, they put in the first alcoholic ward in the state of Texas. And I didn't, just a bunch of old fools over there. They took part of Ward 9 and made an alcoholic ward. What I got thinking about as my memory came back, I know about these alcoholics. I've been going to their stinking AA meetings for 5 or 6 years now. I mean, they're simpletons, but they can be handled. So I was a hospital mailman. I went from ward to ward, and I got old Mr. Ross, Les Ross. He was their counselor out there. And I didn't know this till later. He had volunteered. He was giving his time to show that it could be done. You could help people. And he had people in there on alcoholic commitments in this one ward. But I was in there as a cuckoo. So I stopped him in the hall one day. And I thought, now what does this old fool want to hear? But, Mr. Ross, my name is Clancy Emerson. I'm here on a suicide commitment from El Paso. I said, I understand you have some sort of a program over in Ward 9 that helps people who cannot stop drinking. You know, Mr. Ross, all of my life, I seem to have so much going for me, but I get an obsession to drink, and I can't stop. And I've lost my hope in the bottle of alcohol. And I've lost everything there. Do you have any sort of literature I could read, or any sort of meetings I could go to? Do you have any book I could read? All I want to do is find sobriety on an all-time basis. And his eyes went... And then it's just a matter of time. I just pulled that sumbitch in, boy. He said, I'll get back to you, son. And I waited 3 or 4 days, and he didn't get back to me. And I thought, that old blowhard burned me off. This is really goofy. I may not deliver mail to their ward. Yeah. But he contacted me, and he said, okay, boy, you can start going to our meetings tomorrow. And sometime after that, he told me why it took so long. Because he had to go through Austin, because at that time psychiatric patients were not allowed in the alcoholic ward. It's two different administrations. So I became the pilot study in the state of Texas as to whether or not psychiatric patients could go into alcoholic wards. And they couldn't have found a better test case. Because I wasn't burdened by any sincerity whatsoever. I just... Old Mr. Ross would give us, he'd call us together and give us an hour talk on the 12 steps, for example. You know. And the rest of these guys were all there. They were committed by their families as chronic alcoholics, and they'd stay 30 days and go home. And so they didn't care how, they just didn't like it. I mean, you'd say to the guy, what are you doing to get out of here, Fred? I'm going to kill that bitch. You know. But... But I was not on a 30-day commitment. I was there for the pull, so I became, Mr. Ross would give a long talk, and he'd give a long talk, and he'd say, I'm talking about the 12 steps today, and the whole room would go, not me. I said, good. Can you get all done with an hour of the 12 steps? Is there? Are there any questions, boys? No, he's got... I have a question, Mr. Ross. Could you tell us some more about the fourth and fifth steps and how we unburden ourselves and get this garbage out of our system and find a new... He said, yes, I'll tell you about that right now, Clancy. And the whole rest of the room would say, oh, shit. But I wasn't working on them. I had to get him. And pretty soon I got him. I got to be secretary of the group. They all came and went. I stayed. I got to be secretary. They used to take me out to little towns around there and give talks. I was wonderful. Take me over to Odessa and Midland, San Angelo. I had little talks. I'd give friends. I'm here tonight on behalf of my fellow patients at the Big Spring State Hospital to thank each and every one of you for carrying a message of faith and hope. It's almost as though we were lost in the desert of alcoholism, and we came upon the tall green hills of sobriety, but they were too steep for our weary legs. But folks such as you pointed out 12 golden stairs that we could climb one after another. And now as we reach the top of those steps, we are looking over the other desert of alcoholism. We can't wait to get to our homes through West Texas. Find other lost wayfarers and say, over here, here's the way to the top of the mountain of sobriety. May God bless you in your wonderful work. We appreciate it very much. Now, you can laugh. That got me out of the Texas nut house. And when I came back here, they had to sign my wife to give me 3 big Thorazine a day to hold me down. Some of you young folks don't know what Thorazine is, but that is a stopper. And she'd put it in my plate every meal. She'd watch me eat it. In fact, years later, I heard her talk at Al-Anon meetings. Some of you heard her talk at Al-Anon meetings. And she talks about, I never knew this. I suspected it, but I never knew it. The hospital had her send in a report on me every Saturday night to see if I was acting funny. And if I really got real funny, she was supposed to pick up the phone, they'd come and get me. No hearings, just give them a few more shock treatments. But I knew there was something up because she had such a confident tone all the time around the house. Get that garbage out. Good idea, dear. And between the Thorazine and the remnants of that shock, I was getting along pretty well. And I got a job downtown. A little guy gave me a job in his print shop doing paste-ups. Now, first I got a job in the Texas and Pacific Interchange Yards. Now, I'd been an opera director and a big advertising wizard. Now, somebody put in some clout and got me a job at the T&P Yards. So my job was to be out there between 11 at night and 7 in the morning. And as trains went from the Texas Pacific, when cars went to the Southern Pacific, I'd write down the numbers and turn them in. And some nights when I wasn't feeling well or cross, I'd say, I'm going to put in a bad number. Let those fools in Van Horn try to find this one. But I wasn't mean. I was, those Thorazines on you, you're just kind of nice. And a guy named Eric DeBrine, who had been a good friend of mine, he ran an advertising scene. He gave me a little job, and he gave me a start. And I went to AA and Alamogordo every week, whether I needed it or not. Because that was part of my condition. I'd sit there, and as was said, there weren't very many members, maybe 20, 25. But it seemed like a room full, and they were all old, as was said. Sitting in there, I used to think it's like sitting in God's waiting room. You know, just waiting for some voice to say, next, and one of these guys. And they'd talk about these cockamamie steps and God and how wonderful it is to be sober. And oh, Jesus, give me another Thorazine. And I got some clout. I got a They had a Southwestern Advertising Agency convention here in El Paso the next year. I gave a little talk at that to impress somebody. And somebody said, here's a guy that's had a tough time, but he's got a lot of potential. And I got a job in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South, a firm called Tracy Locke. And I went there. And sometime thereafter, my wife joined me again. I was only one town ahead this time. And 9 months and 10 seconds later, and my wife stayed here. And let me tell you, I hardly ever talk about this to Portland because it's such an extraneous thing. But my wife was still here at Christmas. So I came home at Christmas. She said, I better get some presents for our little girls. I said, don't get any presents. I've got some dough set aside. Now I'm going to come home and do it. And I did. I had a pocket full of money. And I came in on the train. And I went out the house. I said, Charlotte, don't worry. Tomorrow morning, Christmas morning, there's going to be something under that tree. You'll love it. So I said, I'm going down and do a little shopping. Don't tell the kids. So I went downtown. I was going to go into a store, and I ran into a guy I'd worked on the paper with. He says, why don't you come into Gill's and have a beer? I said, well, maybe one. The next morning, I woke up. I remember vaguely being in New Mexico and drinking martinis. And I woke up and sitting in that Silver Dollar, the first bar on the left side of the bridge over there, whatever that was. And it was 3 a.m, and I had no presents. It was Christmas morning, and I was tapped out. The guy was giving me hell because I didn't pay for my last drink. I said, there's got to be some mistake. And there's one other guy in the bar on Christmas morning. And I said, you want to pay for this drink? I don't know what happened. He said, you're just a bum. And I cursed him. As I recall, I don't remember very clearly, but he didn't even take his elbow off the bar. He just went, and knocked me out through the door. And I lay on the street, bleeding from the head. And some people came along that I knew, that I worked with, and they picked me up and took me home. And of course, the house was dark, and they opened the door and put me on the living room floor and left. So 6 o'clock in the morning, all the little kids and mommy got up to see who was under the tree, and just daddy in a pool of blood again, tapped out. And I felt a certain chill around the house that day. But I decided to give him another chance, so I brought him to Dallas. And I did fairly well there for a while. I had a lot of responsibility, and people thought I really was on the ball. But it got out of hand somehow. My problems got too much for me, and I got drinking too much. And well-meaning people thought I was an alcoholic when they didn't understand what my problem really was. And I got fired at that big advertising agency. Finally, I got another little job. I got fired off that, and they stuck me in a hospital. I escaped from that, and I came home on Monday morning after spending my last severance check, and my wife and children were gone. And I don't mean they left for the store. I mean, the furniture was gone. Everything was gone. One pile of clothes in the middle of my living room floor. And they just said, if you ever want to reach us, I'm at this post office box, but don't try to contact us. You're going to kill our kids. And I thought, isn't that just like them? You get a little run of bad luck and they turn on you. Thank God there wasn't any Al-Anon then to spoil it. And a couple weeks after that, I was in El Paso trying to bum money, and people saying, what happened to you? You were supposed to be something in Dallas. You're just a bum. And a couple weeks after that, I woke up one morning and I was on the floor of the Phoenix, Arizona drug tank. And the guy just got done kicking my front teeth out. He said I'd vomited on his bunk. And that morning, I was so sick. But I'll tell you, I was glad that maybe 7 or 8 years before that, I'd spent several thousand dollars in psychoanalysis when I was trying to find my problems. And the reason, because once you've been in psychoanalysis, you get insights and understandings that most people don't have. And that morning, I was so sick, I couldn't even move my head out of the way of his shoe while he literally kicked my teeth out. But I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. Yeah. And a month after that, I was 86th out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles. And I stood in front of that mission. My clothes were gone. My front teeth were gone. Everything was gone. And I thought, this can't be happening to me. And I really had a transitory thought. It might sound funny to you, but it wasn't funny then. I thought, maybe my suicide in El Paso was successful, And this is just the way it's going to be for eternity. Just screwed at every turn. Jesus. And I'll tell you, if a man would have come along with a lie detector and put a lie detector in my arm that day and said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I would have said, "No, I'm not." And that needle wouldn't have quivered. And I'd been in and out of AA for 9 years by now. And I'd had some successes and I'd had some failures. And things were just coming apart. But I wasn't an alcoholic because of one thing, and I'm sure it's the thing that has troubled some of you in your day and may trouble you again. My problem really isn't alcohol. It is sometimes, and I'll swap drinking stories with anybody, but that isn't the problem. Alcoholics, when they get sober, they feel better and live happily ever after. When I get sober, I feel worse. And it's as though drinking gives me at least some sort of rose-colored glasses. When I take them off, everything is just stinking black and white and ugly. And you see it sooner or later. I remember thinking years ago, there's something different about me. I need a technicolor life. Other people like black and white, but I gotta have a technicolor. I want color. I can't stand it. That's one of the problems with AA. You go to AA, that's just, it's an endless gray tunnel. It just goes on and on. Every day you get up and, oh, another gray day. And if you wait a year, you see the guy's way up ahead of you getting a year. What happens? Nothing. A hatch opens and a hand drops some 35-cent pin. Here you are. Is that all there is? Yeah. I don't like black and white living and gray living. To this day, every Christmas when my grandkids are there, I've got one graduating from high school next spring, but fortunately they all keep having babies incessantly, so there's always little grandchildren. And I sit and I watch Wizard of Oz. They showed it at Christmas. I have a granddaughter that's able, or grandson, to sit. We sit there and watch it. I tell them, isn't this fun? Kind of a custom. And every time they get to the end of that movie, if I weren't mature, I would just shout, "Don't go back to Kansas! That's sepia tone! Oz is rotten, but it's colorful. You know, a lot of wicked witches here, but you get used to that. I did. It just seems to me that life has a tendency to gray out when I stay sober too long. No matter what my intentions are, it grays out. And I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish my problems were that simple and non-complex. I sat in AA meetings, it seemed to me, for years. I don't know if I ever heard it, but it always, my mind told me that I heard people saying things like, "Friends, I stayed drunk around the clock for 30 years, and one day I walked through that door, and I knew I was home. I now have $3 million with me. Several different families have returned to me, oh, Jesus. And I've just never felt so wonderful." Well, good for you, pal, but my problem is not alcohol. I don't know what it is. I went to psychoanalysis, spent several thousands of dollars there, discovered things I never would have known. Found out I'd been a deprived child. I didn't know that. That plunged me into depression for a couple months. Didn't even know there'd been a depression until the 1950s. Then that made me cry for over 2 weeks. You know, there's a new group now called Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I guess they get together, I'm sure it has a salutary purpose, to get together and discuss how cruel their parents were when they were little. I'm going to start a group much more therapeutic than that. It's going to be called Adult Children of Christians. They never pass out. The heat is on all the time, especially when you have a slightly evil bent. And I found in psychoanalysis that I'd been warped by my parents' religious training. I'd been warped by this and warped by that. I tell you, I came out of there almost every day and have a drink. And just said, it's amazing I'm doing as well as I am, for Christ's sake. With the amount of scarring I've had. But I fell into the trap that a lot of people fall into. That trap is this. Thinking that if I can find out why I feel rotten, it'll get better. And a lot of people pursue it. You read philosophy, you do things. But I'm going to tell you a secret, in case you haven't found it out. When you find out why you feel rotten, the only change is you now know why you feel rotten. The only help at all is if you're in a bar somewhere and a guy says, "What the hell's wrong with you?" You can tell him. But they don't want to listen. I read things. I did a lot of things. But the one thing I discovered early in my life, I discovered as a boy of 15 on a ship outside of Pearl Harbor early in the Second World War, and it stayed with me all my life. A few drinks makes it better. A few drinks build up my confidence. A few drinks keeps away anxiety. A few drinks makes me able to make small talk. A few drinks makes me feel desirable as a human being. A few drinks helps me overcome loneliness. I can be alone, but I'm not lonely. A few drinks helps me to not be threatened by things around me. A few drinks fills the holes, apparently, that are in my psyche. I don't know how they got there, but they're there, and a few drinks fills them up. And I'll tell you, I know it's no lasting answer. I know it's a self-delusion in a sense. But by God, we all know the feeling. There are days that I just don't want to be a wimp anymore. I don't want to be so emotional. I don't want to be these things. I don't want to have to be frightened of those dirty bastards. When I have a few drinks, I'm not. And when my holes are filled, I am never better. I can make small talk. I get along with people. I write well. I feel confident. I see things clearly. I don't get rejected. I reject. What a great feeling. Maybe some of you young guys, I'm sure some of you old guys have had the experience in years gone by, watching that miracle that sometimes happens in a bar late at night. When you watch with just a few well thought out drinks, you can watch a miracle. You can watch an old bag turn into a stunner by closing time. And that stringy gray hair somehow turns into platinum. And those wrinkles become laugh lines. I might go over at the end of the bar when the bar is closing and imply to her that there may be delights beyond her comprehension if she would like to accompany me after the bar closes. If she says, "Now, when my holes are filled, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her." Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. If that would happen to me sober, I would walk into the washroom and hang myself. That, in a nutshell, is why I drink. And the only problem I've ever had is that somehow, for some reason I could never understand, from time to time, I have a tendency to overfill my holes. One of the classic all-time patterns of alcoholism. One that most alcoholics have been in. In fact, there's a whole bunch written about specifically about it in chapter 3 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It starts off by saying, it talks about what we have in common. What do we have in common? If you're new today, you may wonder, what do all these people in common? This big mouth from California and all these people, different sizes and shapes and colors and creeds and lengths of sobriety and jobs. What do we have in common? Not certainly how much we drank, not where we drank it, not even the state. What do we all have in common? The one thing that all of us have in common, apparently, is that we, along the way, got trapped in an obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. The persistence, the book says, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. Then it goes on to talk how you have brief recoveries. We've all had those. Followed always by still worse relapse. It eventually always gets worse. Until you get to a point that's such a delicious choice of words. Reaching a point finally of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I used to think that's how drunk you got. But that's how you get when you're sober. When you're sobered up again and you're faced with the whole thing coming down on you and the guilt and remorse and the accusations and the queasiness and the despair. We talk a lot about drunks attempting to commit suicide. Most people at one time or another have tried to commit suicide drunk. I'll show you. I'll kill myself. Then you'll be sorry. Yeah. But the remarkably few drunken people succeed at suicide. Isn't that funny? And of those that do, it is felt that many of them are accidental because they're trying to do something about it and they can't get to the door or to the phone. I think it's always been my feeling the reason that alcoholics, the drunks who commit suicide, don't want to commit suicide finally because they suddenly realize, I'm not going to be here to watch them be sorry. I've gotten calls and, Clancy, I just want you to know I was. Appreciate all the help you've given me, but I've decided to end it all. I've taken a massive overdose of pills. I want anyone to disturb me at 1421 2nd Street. Do you know when most successful alcoholic suicides take place? Within a few days of after getting sober again, in sobriety. And there are no notes, as a rule. When I killed myself here, I didn't leave any note. When I tried to drunkenly commit suicide, I used to leave long letters. No notes. You're just pitiful and incomprehensible. Just get me out. I can't face him anymore. I can't face myself. I can't face anything. And I wish my problems were simple, like they said. I wish that stopping drinking would change it. But it doesn't. I wish it were that simple. I wish I didn't have these emotional shifts and changes and turns and make up my mind, this is what I'm going to do, and then a week later say, oh, screw it, I'm tired of doing that, and do something else, and on, and just no way to justify it. And I had no idea the nature of my illness, and I believe that's what kills nearly all alcoholics who die from it. Is the nature, not knowing the nature of the illness. And it doesn't mean you haven't been to AA. Every long-term drinker has been to AA now, it seems like. On my job, some of you know, almost every day, I see alcoholics dying. I don't mean figuratively dying. I mean dying dead and having a cart come and take them away dead. And I see people going over the edge into irreversible brain damage, alcoholic insanity, Korsakoff syndrome. And I see people just in dreadful stress. And I don't know any of them that haven't been to AA. They've all been to AA. And they say, but AA doesn't work for me because my case is different. Or I don't want it. Or I'd leave me alone. And I understand that. I used to say the same thing. These guys are dying. But the one thing they know They are not really alcoholics because their problem is different. And I'm sure that all of us in this room will intermittently have that thought cross our mind. I'm not really an alcoholic like the real alcoholics. I just been kind of had the situation. And most just stop and think. It's such a difficult thing. This organization is made up of people who one of their major characteristics is they come here absolutely convinced their case is different. That's a strange thing to have in common, isn't it? Our case is all different. I was thinking about that before the meeting. I was talking to a friend of mine who I'd seen in Montreal, and some of you I know were at Montreal at the International Convention. But I just couldn't believe it. In a stadium, Montreal Olympic Stadium, 50,000 people. Their baseball team hasn't drawn that many people total for all summer, for Christ's sake. And here's a 50,000 people, all of them sober alcoholics, all of them up and excited, and there's just electricity in the air before the meeting starts. Let me say one thing in passing, that through a strange series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, probably based on my experience at the Big Spring Christmas pageant, I was asked to direct this intricate flag ceremony where before the meeting starts, people from all over the world, all the nations of the world, brought in their national flag, and we had worked out this hideous goddamn choreography. And this one guy, it was almost time to start, and I still couldn't, he had a simple thing. I don't want to put down any national groups, but he was from Poland. He really was from Poland. And I finally called him aside. And I said, look, we're running a little short of time. I don't want to holler at you and I'll make amends later. But God damn it, there are 50,000 people waiting to get this rehearsed. Now look, when I give you a signal like that, step forward, wave your flag once this way, step back, and then turn this way and go. Just do what the guy in front of you is doing, for Christ's sake. It can't be that big a deal. And he smiled at me and said, "Trumpel it, you're not, brother." I thought, oh, shit. Yeah. Do whatever you want, you goof. As it turned out, when we did it, he did it right, but he had hurt me too much before that. But it really was a beautiful thing. And you saw something in that meeting, I bet you no one has ever seen an AA meeting before or since. Just before the meeting started, everybody was so up in this full baseball stadium, some guys down there started to wave, and they had a wave going around that AA meeting. Around and around. And it just made me almost get a tear in my eye to think, every one of us have no business being here. True story. And every one of us in this room have no business being here. Because there's a people a lot better than you and me out on that street, and they will never make it. It's hard to remember that 97 or 98% of alcoholics still die drunk. And it's not because there's no answer available. An answer is available. It's that they cannot allow themselves to open up to understand the nature of the illness and what a brutal battle it is. And what a self-deceiving thing it is. One other thing. I talked to this guy about... I was pleased up there to speak on sponsorship. And that was a big crowd, 6,000. And I had not spoken in a situation. There was a girl down at the end. If you want everyone to talk and have fun, be talking over here. And here's a girl over here going... for the hearing impaired. And I pointed out there, I'll never get asked to speak to the convention again, but I had, I said, in our group we have a little different. We have hearing impaired, but we don't have a girl who does that. We just have a guy who stands next to you. And you say, my name is Clancy and I'm an alcoholic. And he says, my name is Clancy. Well, don't buy that tape, I'll tell you. But what I'm trying to say is, if people, as strange as I am, are sponsors, everybody can have a chance, for Christ's sake. Now, what I want to just quickly say, what is the nature of the illness that avoids this? I'll bet I could so easily have died. I got scars on my wrist from drunkenly scratching at my wrist and carbon monoxide in my lungs and all. And I've run away so many times, and a lot of people have done these things. And I bet my life, if there's an answer, I would get it, but there's no answer. These are well-meaning people. And they give me this God stuff and turn it over and all this stuff, but that doesn't work out there in the real world. Out there, they're animals, by God. I'd like to be a good man in a good world, but they won't let you. And if you let them, they'll screw you around. Now, the most important thing I've got to say today, or before I sit down, I said a long time ago, nobody paid any attention to it. I said, my name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. That was the single most difficult thing for me to come to believe in my life. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic when I drank. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic when I got sober. And I didn't believe I was an alcoholic really after that. I was just hanging around that club, pretending to be an alcoholic so I could get out of Los Angeles, like I got out of Big Spring. Just play their sick little game with them for a while till I could make a score. And I stayed here long enough, and I got a sponsor who, unfortunately, was not a thoughtful, considerate sponsor. He was a nasty old puke. I'd say, can't we sit down and reason about this? He said, no! Just do what I tell you, for Christ's sake. I said, in my judgment, that doesn't work. He says, in your judgment, you're living in the back seat of an abandoned car. Who cares about your judgment? If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the window and ask you for it. There were times I was so upset with that old fool. If I would have had the money, I would have called the World Service Office in New York and just said, just wants you to know, there's an old-timer in California killing newcomers. And I'll tell you his name. Now it's 26 and a half years later. It's a funny thing. When I talk to the World Service Office in New York, I don't say that. I say, no, I'm not. I had to come to learn the single most important fact I know about this illness. And sometimes you got to be here a while to understand it. And sometimes people are here a long time and never find out. But here's what I believe, because I have never seen this to fail. I had to eventually come to understand that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I am an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Now, doesn't that sound upside down and heretical? But I believe that's the message of this book, because this is the only therapy I've got, is this one I'm at. And that's the message of everything I try to do. But you say, how can that be? Of course, alcohol is the problem. It's so easily disproved. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes should turn out winners. Hospitals should turn out winners. Treatment centers should turn out winners. Jails should turn out winners. Toilets should turn out winners. You know, you can talk all you want about the famous treatment centers, but still the classic American detox is in your own toilet. You know, just not very many people here have knelt in the morning and gazed into those shimmering waters and waiting for a meaningful answer to surface. Say your morning prayer. Oh, God! You hardly ever stop to think you're getting a free detox. Look, Betty, this one won't go on the insurance. If getting sober were the answer, we'd all be home free. But getting sober is not the answer. Because it turns out we don't suffer from alcohol. We suffer from it, but that's not the nature of the illness. We suffer from something that sounds like alcohol and is often confused by people who are even dying from it. And we talk a lot about drinking in meetings, but it is not alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. And the difference between an alcohol problem and the disease of alcoholism is based as many things, but the number one bottom line is this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In the disease of alcoholism, you will come to understand that stopping drinking has no significant effect except to inexorably make your life more painful. Sobriety is the deadly aspect of alcoholism. If it weren't, no one would ever die from it. And everybody in this room knows how that is when you're sober. And there's a certain surge that comes with not drinking, but reality comes in again. And the nervousness and the tension and the feelings of being different a little bit and the things not working out and the frustrations and the depressions and the just want to run. And one day you just get to a point where you can hardly stand it. And you're willing to do almost, to take any chance. This time I will control and enjoy it. I just can't be like this. They think my problem is alcohol. My problems are real because I'm sober. And I can see them. And nobody really understands what I'm going through. I bet there isn't a person in this room that hasn't said that. And then you... Now that in itself doesn't make you an alcoholic. Something else must be present to be an alcoholic. Alcohol has to have a special effect on your body. And we've all heard that again and again. Then you have to just puzzle me. You know, they say things like, if you're an alcoholic, alcohol has a special effect on your body. And I asked a guy one time in a meeting 30 years ago, what's the special effect? Well, if you stop drinking, if you take one drink, it'll settle such a craving, you can't stop. I went out of that meeting at the Lord's Prayer and went right across the street to a bar to test it. I wonder. I'm going to find out once and for all. No craving. Thank Christ. But I'm not one of those. You hear podiums, these guys say, I had a glass of beer and I jumped out of a bush on a nun. Now that's an alcoholic, not me. What is this special effect? Makes you stay drunk? Not at all. You hear guys now, you say, I stay drunk for 30 years. You say, now that's an alcoholic. I'll tell you a little something. When I was sober a few years, I was working in a medical corporation in Los Angeles. I stumbled on a little fact that my sponsor told me this, but I didn't believe it until I read it elsewhere. It is physically impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory. To say nothing on the street. That's the rottenest part about being a drinker. You get sober again and again and again. You don't need any help to get sober. You'll get sober again and again. You may be sick, but you'll get sober. The body, the level of alcohol in your body will fall way below intoxication. It isn't that you stay drunk all the time. That isn't the special effects. Well, maybe it's that you can't handle alcohol the way social drinkers can. False. In fact, it is my belief, the belief of most people who study it. Alcoholics, when they're in their prime, can handle alcohol better than almost any social drinker. If you ever went to a party and drank drink for drink with a social drinker, I almost bet you drove him home. You know, they do. But you can never get the pukes to drink for a drink as a rule. They say things like, oh, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it. Feel that, why don't you? What does alcohol do to me that it doesn't do to anybody else in my family? I've been asked that question and reading and listening for 26 years and 11 months. And to my best knowledge, I would say, alcohol does nothing to me. It doesn't do to everybody who drinks it. But now what? What is the special effect then? The special effect that makes an alcoholic is something I never would have thought of by myself in 10,000 years. But once I learned it from my betters, it made everything fall into place. It isn't what alcohol does to me. It's what alcohol does for me. It does something different for me than it does for 93% of the people who drink alcohol. It has the ability to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It almost instantly changes my relationship to my environment. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained, and them smaller and less frightening to me. It almost instantly fills my hole. And if it does that, it's great. And I never once guessed it didn't do that for other people. I thought they just didn't have the holes to fill. I never knew that. And eventually, of course, there's one sad thing about it. If it does that for you, it gradually detracts from your ability to cope with reality, even if you have any ability. Because living in reality requires certain emotional conditionings and tools. And no one is going to spend voluntarily 2 weeks going through a painful problem when I can get rid of the goddamn thing in 5 minutes. Screw you, household finance. Things stay the same, but they look different. And the people who live with us try to see it our way, and they get crazy and have to become Al-Anon because they're trying to adjust to what torn terribly, just hideous. Now, there's nothing wrong with this except for one thing. Eventually, alcohol begins to do something to you. Then you got to stop. But you can't, realities become a little untenable. So you drink. Then you get sober again. Then you got to try to stop. And that condition where sobriety becomes untenable and now drinking has become untenable, that is called alcoholism. And nearly everybody who has it dies from it, convinced I'm not an alcoholic because my real problems were real things. The drinking was just a result. But both conditions have to exist. And the reason that's important to remember, so you will never fall into that terrible trap of thinking AA is a place to get sober. AA is a place to become religious. AA is a place to come to cram course, a study course. And people who think that don't stay here. The purpose of AA, to the best of my knowledge, and all of its actions, and its involvements, and its sponsors, and its people you sponsor, and its inventories, and its being involved, and founders' days, and conventions, and daily meetings, and weekly meetings, and amends we make that doesn't seem we should have to make them, but we have to make them anyway. And all these things are what to do what? To make you wonderful? Forget it. No matter how hard you work your program, you will never rise above human being. And human beings don't stay wonderful. It's to do something infinitely more complex in a way that you cannot understand till it begins to happen. All of these actions are designed to begin to fill the holes that only alcohol did before. I don't know of any better way to put it. You may sometimes your own... There's going to be a lot of times when your mind is not going to be your friend. Don't listen to it. Probably before I close, I'll say the best way I've ever had this described to me, and I was about a year sober. And I hadn't intended to stay sober, but I could never get a score, so I was still sober. And I got a job wrapping packages in the back of a little advertising agency in Los Angeles. The same kind of job I'd had when I was 14. That's what you call rocket to stardom in the AA program. At least my wife hadn't shown up. And one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. I'm sure some of you, I don't know if you ever saw the billboards, but they had the same billboards for 40 years in California. Vodka is pronounced Kamchatka. And they were old when I worked there, 1959. So I came by one day with my packages. I'm going to let these guys know that there's a real sharp guy in the back room wrapping packages. And he'll ask me, where are you from? I said, oh, I've been a big executive.
You have? Here, let us give you a start. So I just had to get my move in.
So I came out of that Pax Business, guys were laying out a new billboard. I said,
so I've got an idea. Instead of that same old slogan, why don't you put on something like, Kamchatka vodka goes boom, better than all vodkas anywhere. And I waited, and they looked up at me and got the same look I've been getting all my life. Just, and one guy really got cross with me. He said, is that supposed to be funny? You know, you get a bad reputation of being a smart mouth. If I had a mouth like yours, I'd keep it shut. It looks bad and sounds bad. If you don't like the way we do our billboards, we're hired to do it. Why don't you go wrap some goddamn packages somewhere else?
I couldn't believe my ears. I would have killed him, except I didn't. I was afraid to explain to my sponsor. I just went crazy after. I was going to quit the job. I was going to run away. You know, you make one suggestion, they don't have to accept it, but at least they can listen. But to publicly humiliate you when you're sober a year, and I saw my sponsor be like that, I said, Bob! Hold it down, for Christ's sake. If you can't be a man, act like one anyway. Shh. He said, now, what the hell's wrong? And I told him this whole story. Bob, you know, I dicked my inventory. I've done all these things like you said. And I gave him this one suggestion, and I just humiliated me. It was a good slogan, and they humiliated me, Bob. I'm not a piece of crap, you know. I'm a human being. He said, listen. When he got very upset, he used to wave his finger under my nose. That's the only time I ever really missed my front teeth. You know, just, ah. But I didn't want to give him the pleasure of gumming it, I'll tell you that. He said, listen, they're not humiliating you. Don't you ever listen to what we have all been telling you for a year? They're not humiliating you. They don't know what the hell you're talking about. Can't you understand this? Kamchatka vodka doesn't go boom to them. To them, it goes blah, blah, blah. That's why you're in this goddamn meeting and they're not.
Oh, my God. Oh, I said, I could have told you that. But you might think about that someday when you're under pressure and strain and think, maybe I'm just a social drinker. You're not a social drinker. Do you think that when you're under pressure and the hounds of fate are ripping at your throat, you're trying to give them an effect like this? Oh, God. No more for me. You are looking for the same thing I'm looking for, if I were to do it. When your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate at your throat. Oh, God. It doesn't go. It goes. Bring on your goddamn hound, Mrs. Baskerville. If it does that for you, it must surely kill you. And that is not a joke. That is a fact. And so that's why you and I have to do things to, in sobriety, to alter our perception of sobriety, to fill our hole. I've had no therapy since October 1958, except AA, and I already knew all about it. But the first time I really was forced to do it on a continuing basis, it worked. And it's worked up to this day. And 5 years, when I was sober, 5 years, I'd become director of an advertising department, big medical corporation. Same wife and all those children. Heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later. He's a sophomore at the University of New Mexico now, and I can't even push him right. What would you like now, son? But here I am in a world in which I could not live. What I have to say to you is this. I am grateful that AA forced me to take action that eventually altered my perspectives enough to live in the world, to again, and maybe for the first time since I was 3 years old, believe in the God that I thought was interested in my welfare rather than my punishment. To work with others, to live in the world with a certain degree of stability, that's why it's so important for me, because things have been going so well for me for so many years, it's almost silly. That's why I'm excited about coming here. I was just thrilled to see Pearl. When I see Pearl, I see her as this nice lady, but I also see, I remember lying under a bed down by the railroad station, sick and knowing I can't get up and face Mr. Mithoff tomorrow, and what am I going to do, and the rent's due. And I see, I think of old Tobe Rousseau, who was an old-timer in the El Paso group, talking to me, saying, son, you got to do this. But you don't understand, Tobe. And I really believed what I said. It isn't as though you've thrown away your life for the fun of it. You really believe it. So it gets down to this. You have to suspend your disbelief for a while. As my sponsor says, nobody cares how it looks to you. Your way doesn't work, goof. You just do it. Come to join us. Walk in a trudge on a path that eventually becomes the path of happy destiny. Hopefully develop a little enthusiasm. That's the greatest thing I've got in A, some enthusiasm for AA. I remember a guy telling me one time, you know how lucky you are, because that's from a Greek root. En meaning within, theos meaning God. You get a little God within, enthusiasm, and feel like, much to my surprise, just think, if my suicide would have been successful in 1956 up here in El Paso, I would have been guilty of killing the wrong man. I never would have known that the world was okay. I'm glad that I didn't die that day. I'm glad that you're having this Founders Day. I know you all have your reasons for being here, but I have my reason, because it makes me grateful that I'm safe and sane and sober and need not be alone again. Thank you.
We're all grateful to Clancy for the special effort that he made to get here to El Paso to share in our 40th anniversary. I also want to express my personal gratitude to all the people that helped to make this happen, that helped me and tolerated somewhat abrasive personality in my aggressiveness to get all these things tied together so that we could do this today. I really am deeply grateful to everybody that participated. Also, I want to say that the tapes of these speakers today are available. We have commemorative T-shirts. We are going to have a wrap party after this is all over, and that is that we're going to load that 40-foot military truck back, and we're going to need some help there. I hope everybody enjoyed the food and had a happy Founders Day. Thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. I love you very much.